It's true. Across the globe, women aren't as prosperous as men. Gender inequality is a pressing moral issue, but we forget it has massive economic implications. If you were to put all of the women who don't have access to formal financial services in one place, they would make up the third largest country in the world. That means an entire population without bank accounts, credit cards, or other tools you and I likely benefit from daily. Prosperity for women starts with inclusive policies, products, and people around the globe, and the investment to make it happen. Welcome to the Making Finance Work for Women podcast. My name is Sonia Kelly, and I lead Women's World Banking's proprietary research division. Join me as I speak with changemakers around the globe to deconstruct the social and economic exclusion women face. We'll discover new evidence together and drive action to accelerate women's economic empowerment. Because a leg up isn't a handout, it's a global game changer. Welcome, and thank you so much for tuning in to the Making Finance Work for Women podcast, streaming on LinkedIn Live and on demand on the official financial inclusion platform this week. I'm your host, Sonia Kelly. Before we get started, I'd like to give a special shout out to Women's World Banking's Making Finance Work for Women sponsors. Our leading sponsor is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Our scaling sponsor is Ernst & Young. Our broadening sponsors are the MetLife Foundation and the European Investment Bank. And supporting sponsors, the Sasakawa Peace Foundation, United Nations Capital Development Fund, and the International Finance Corporation. We're also incredibly grateful to our core funders for enabling our strategy, including Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, the Swedish International Development Cooperation Agency, and Visa Foundation. You too can join our sponsors in supporting us by going to our website. It's easy, www.womensworldbanking.org, and click the Take Action link at the top of the page. We'd love to see you there. This podcast comes during Financial Inclusion Week. It's a global virtual gathering of the inclusive finance community. And if this is your first time joining us for the podcast and you found us through Financial Inclusion Week, we're so glad you're here. You can follow Women's World Banking on LinkedIn so that you don't miss the next episode. We're always live the third Thursday of the month with a special guest. It's something that I actually send around to my family and friends because it's a nice window into this world that I engage with every day. And I think it's really quality content. So we're glad you're here, and we hope you join us in the future as well. Today, we're going to be discussing gender lens investing and specifically how it can be an on-ramp to measurable social goals in investors' and companies' environmental, social, and governance goals. And I'll get into what those three things are. But I want to give like a little bit more context and an introduction to the topic, because I think sometimes people hear investing and then they think like, oh, that's like too advanced for me. It's like, it's too much. But it's very relevant. It's very action oriented, and it's very important to low income people around the world. And I'll talk a little bit about that. Gender lens investing is not only about pursuing gender equality as a social good for its own sake, but it's a strategy for financial performance. Investing in women as customers of financial institutions and as employees and leadership in those institutions leads to stronger institutions overall, better returns for investors, and a more equitable world. And this model is incredibly sustainable and incredibly socially oriented. We've been talking a lot recently in this podcast about climate. It was a big topic of conversation last month when we talked about migration issues associated with climate. And I think this conversation we're going to have today actually very closely ties into that. And stick with me for a second. There's an acronym you may have heard called ESG. ESG means environment, that's the E. S is social, and G is governance. ESG. Often companies focus on the E, the environment, because there's, you know, we've probably heard greenwashing, and it's not all that. Hopefully very little of it is that. But companies focus on this environmental aspect of ESG. But you can't focus on E without looking at gender equality, a distinct part of the social part of ESG. If I were a lyricist, I could write a very clever song using all of these acronyms like, I don't know, S drives the EG, and it would sound very clever. But in any case, I hope that becomes clear, though, in our conversation about the interconnectedness of all three parts of ESG, or environmental, social, and governance investments. Here's an example of how it works. Women's unique knowledge and experiences have proven invaluable in developing effective climate solutions, emphasizing the need to include their perspectives in decision-making, which is also a governance issue. And women's livelihoods, particularly in rural areas, are disproportionately affected by climate change due to their roles in managing resources, in food production, in livestock, all of which are susceptible to climate disruptions. I want to talk about a personal conversation I had with a woman in Indonesia who is about my age, actually. She was an orange farmer living on the island of Java in Indonesia. The land on which she farmed was a land that she didn't own, but she was allowed to farm on it because it was her husband's family's farm. And she was able to very clearly articulate to me and our team of researchers the challenges of crop management, how a poor crop could devastate her financially. Even so, she sent us away with a bag of oranges and a lot of hugs and smiles, and she was really upbeat about her life. But as I walked away, I thought about the fact that Indonesia is, according to the World Bank, a very high-risk country when it comes to climate. Approximately 40% of Indonesia's 256 million residents are at risk. And climate is national news in the country. The capital of Indonesia actually just moved, or is moving this year, from Jakarta to Nusantara. And so, like, it's very relevant, very real for Sunarti, even though it's not top of mind for her. The sustainable practices that she uses demonstrate how women can contribute to environmental sustainability given the opportunity. And we know that large-scale climate risk mitigation requires the formal financial inclusion of women like Sunarti, like access to credit to purchase sustainable farming technology. And women are the stewards of the planet's resources and highly exposed to climate change when they're in these roles. We know as well, nearly a billion women remain excluded from the formal financial system, hindering their ability to thrive amidst climate-related threats and risks. And for the past 40 years, women's world banking has positively impacted hundreds of millions of low-income women by integrating them into the formal financial system, resulting in profound effects on their families, their communities, and the global economy. In fact, in 2020, our asset management arm invested in a company called Pula. This is a crop microinsurance company. The investment enabled Pula to prioritize a gender-balanced workforce. And we've seen women in the workforce have a direct correlation to the number of women customers across the institutions in which we work, it's not an exception with Pula. Pula's insurance for smallholder women farmers, it's an increasing customer base for them, allows them to endure yield risks, improve their farming practices, and bolster their incomes over time in the face of climate change. This isn't just charity or like a bunch of do-gooders. There's a business case here and a return on investment. We've seen clear positive correlations between staff and client gender diversity figures and return on equity. So to grow your business, you grow your gender diversity. We've also seen more women at all levels of workforces, and not just leadership, lead to attracting and retaining more women customers, like I just said in the case of Pula and our other investments. And we've also seen a clear positive correlation at Women's World Banking between between women loan officers and outreach to women clients. We've shared some of that in stuff that we've published recently in the last few years. In addition, we have a research study that revealed that the underperformance of women-owned SME was due to poorer outreach, conversely, poorer customer care, and poor credit assessment of women-owned businesses. And once addressed, this trend reversed to overperformance. So you can see how investment in these companies that are taking steps towards women's financial inclusion can make a big social difference that drives overall change. So that's my introduction. I think maybe we're going to get more into these themes when we talk to our guest. So enough from me. Let me now welcome our guest, Ivan Chu. He's the Director of Impact at Brightlight Group. Welcome, Ivan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining. We always like to start by asking our guests about like their origin story, how you got into it. And your title is really cool. And so I want to hear a little bit more about how you got into this space, but also what you do in your current job.
So I started my career in banking and private equity. This was many years ago. And after a few years on, I moved on to strategy consulting, corporate development. So I did a bit of everything. It was in 2018 when I moved back to Australia, where I was in Singapore previously, that I was kind of looking for a bit of a career change, I suppose, wanting to utilize sort of existing skill sets acquired during my roles in banking and private equity to make a difference and to have a more sort of meaningful pathway, I suppose. And that was when I caught up with an old friend of mine and discovered that he was involved in impact investing. And at that point, it was sort of a coined term that was still in its sort of infancy in Australia, but it was gaining traction. And I think that whole concept just sort of resonated with me. And fast forward in 2021, I'm at Brightlight now. And I'm currently responsible for development and integration of our impact strategies and framework within our existing investment processes, but also with our products and solutions. I also support clients who are looking to be more thoughtful and intentional about impact investing and impact management and measurement across various impact teams, and that includes gender lens. So that's a little short story of my origin.
Yeah, so you're familiar with both traditional investment and impact investing and gender lens investing. How do these things differ from one another for our listeners who are just hearing about this for the first time?
I guess fundamentally, gender lens investing is kind of a strategy or approach to investing that specifically takes into consideration gender-based factors across the entire investment process. And I think the key with there is being intentional and also being aware of such biasness. Those are, in my opinion, the two key elements that kind of differentiates gender lens investing from traditional investment. Aside from that, I think in terms of assessing the viability of a particular investment or strategy, the rest of them kind of, stays the same, I suppose, it's similar.
I can imagine with gender lens investing, it might be tempting for a company just to reduce like gender lens investing to a set of metrics, like just a few metrics, like, oh, if we hit a certain number of women customers, or if we have a certain proportion of our employees that are women, we did it. But the way you just talked about it was more about intentionality through the process. So can you tell me about that intentionality? Like, how do you keep it from being a set of metrics?
Yeah. For us at Brightlight, we have sort of four key steps that we follow in terms of trying to integrate gender considerations into the process, as you mentioned. Otherwise, it's as simple as, tracking a particular metric, which may or may not be be a result of what you intended to achieve anyway. It's kind of like a byproduct, I suppose, and it just happens to happen that way. So step one, we like to define your organization gender goals and approach in terms of understanding what a particular client's commitments to diversity and impact on top of what they require for investment parameters. What does diversity of their investment team look like? Understanding what their investment committee look like. So that's kind of like the, I guess, the discovery period while helping them to form their own organization approach to gender goals. Follow on from there will be deal origination. So what does their current investment deal flow look like? What channels or sources do they rely on getting access to investments? What kind of funds or investments are they due diligencing? Are those opportunities diverse enough? If not, do they need to update their investment policy or mandate to specify X number or ratio for diversity in investments, and maybe even specifically targeting women-led and first-time funds? So that integrates the intentionality into deal origination. And then subsequently flowing on to due diligence, working with them to develop a process and questionnaire that integrates diversity focus on power dynamic questions and research into the process. Obviously training the team to listen and be aware and analyze their own biasness when it comes to assessing some managers or some investments is also a part of that. And incentivizing gender diversity or other forms of diversity outcomes as conditions of capital commitment should they proceed is another key step. And this sometimes can be achieved via sort of side letter agreements or even as part of the main sort of investment agreements. And finally, when it comes to monitoring outcomes, I think how are we holding ourselves accountable in moving forward when investing in, say, women first-time funds? Is there a target number of funds for review? What percentage made it through the diligence process? And how can we help them shape and refine that process better? So it's kind of like, a sort of circular feedback loop that then once they understand their outcomes, hopefully they can better refine their goals and then the sort of the process. I think it's a, it's an iterative process, and it's a journey as we find with a few of our clients.
Okay, so I'd love to pick up on, you said a few of our clients, and we were connected to you through the Sasakawa Peace Foundation, who I mentioned is one of the sponsors of this podcast. And so I'd actually love it if you would be willing to share a case study of impact measurement in that process. Is it possible for you to share what this looks like in practice with that case example of Sasakawa Peace Foundation?
Special shout out first to Sasakawa Peace Foundation. They're a great people and organization to work with.
We
and
totally agree. Great
things. In the gender lens space. Sure. And so where we supported them was, I think at the start, obviously they have had their impact thesis in place and they've made a few investments and they wanted to, again, be more thoughtful and intentional, specifically about impact measurement. And that's where they came to Brightlight and we sort of helped them first build out an impact management and measurement framework, what we call an IMM framework. And that helps them align and prove out their impact thesis. At the moment, there are three key pillars for their Asia Women Impact Fund, which invests in women financial inclusion funds across Southeast Asia and Asia. The first pillar being providing access to financial capital. And the key outcomes there are improving access to capital for women entrepreneurs, as well as increasing women ownership in portfolio companies. The second pillar being improving women economic opportunities and livelihood. And these outcomes targeted are creating employment and income opportunities for women throughout the value chain, as well as providing services and products that contributes to the quality of women's lives. And finally, promoting gender equality in the workplace. And that includes sort of in leadership and management positions, equal opportunity and inclusion of women and men in the workplace. So that's kind of like the three key goals, I suppose, and three key pillars that we base that framework on. And subsequently, once we have helped them build out that framework, we then supported them to build the tools that will support them to do this IMM analysis and monitoring. We adopted the IMP or Impact Management Project, now Impact Frontiers, five dimensions of impact, which is the what, who, how, much contribution and risk framework for some of you guys are familiar. For fund and investee analysis, we helped them build a impact alignment scorecard that's based on that IMP framework to assess the alignment of investments with the fund's thesis from an impact perspective and how that lines up with that three key pillars that they talked about earlier. We also integrated a IMM risk sort of assessment framework. This was developed by New Philanthropy Capital, which we find was really a good tool to understand where each investments or where each fund managers are at in terms of their IMM journey. And so then once we understand where they're at, we can sort of help them progress towards, best practice, I suppose. And then finally, adopting the IRIS catalog of metrics. So IRIS Plus or Gene IRIS Plus is, sort of impact, has a catalog of impact metrics that tracks contribution to the sustainable development goals. Expanding on the IRIS metrics as well, they have increasingly across thematics, not only in gender lens, they have various metrics that makes it easier for investors like ourselves to compare and contrast how our each investment is doing. So they're starting to help promote comparability, which has been a key sort of challenge when it comes to impact measurement. And then finally, just supporting them on ongoing measurement, monitoring and measurement, which is currently what we're doing with them. I'm helping them collecting data and insights from each fund manager. One of the interesting initiatives we have this year with them is we're supporting them to conduct a beneficiary survey with an investee company of Women's World Banking. And this is Sitara. Sitara is the financial inclusion investee that provides home loans for underserved women in India. So specifically this for this study, we want to understand, I guess, the well-being outcomes as well as the financial health indicators. And so we're right in the start of that process. In the next few months, we hope to share some results from that study.
Yeah, I was so glad when I heard that you all were involved in that study. I think measuring women's economic empowerment is so important. And we started our conversation talking about how this is not a set of metrics, and it's a process, it's an approach, it's comprehensive. But metrics are incredibly important, because how do you know when you are successful? Like, you need metrics to tell you, like, this is a proxy goal that is an indicator of this larger change we want to see in the world. And then you can track it over time. So I think that focus and you talked about putting that together for Sitara's for Sasakawa Peace Foundation, is just so critically important. Let's turn to talking now about another acronym. That's the one I started talking about at the beginning, ESG, Environmental, Social, and Governance Impact. And one of the things that we've been chatting about internally at Women's World Banking is the fact that what we see out there in the world is the S, where we put oftentimes gender lens investing, the S in ESG often takes a backseat to environmental goals. So one, do you agree in terms of ESG strategy? But also in your experience, if you agree, why do you think this is happening? And how can companies like prioritize social impact in light of a lot of the conversations we're seeing right now in the international space being focused on climate?
Yeah, 100% agree. And I think we're seeing that live, especially in Australia, and I'm sure abroad as well. If you break down sort of the type of impact investments that focus on, say, environmental and social, I think it's kind of disproportionately weighted towards environmental goals. And that's largely, you know, via sort of bonds and whatnot, which are large in nature. But still, I think the number is like some ridiculous 90% environment, 9-to-1 or 8-to-2 ratio. That's just, yeah. And I think part of that is because, or at least it appears to be, that social outcomes appear relatively subjective relative to environmental outcomes. People think that they're harder to measure, more expensive to measure and account for. It's a complex process for IMM or impact measurement. Whereas in environmental, you know, it seems to be a relatively easy pathway. You know, it depends on how much renewable energy you're generating or carbon emissions you're avoiding, so on and so forth. So I guess that's kind of where, yeah, how we got to this sort of disproportionate statistics.
Yeah, 8-to-2 ratio. I have not heard that, and that is tremendously discouraging. But I'm hoping this podcast will help, actually. Okay, I have like 10 more questions. We're going to have to prioritize because we have limited amount of time here. The next one I want to ask is, I don't know, maybe a little bit controversial. I know there are going to be people out there who are listening who say, like, okay, Ivan and Sonia, this is just very Pollyanna. You're talking about a utopia in which social goals align with investor priorities and company bottom lines. So I'm wondering, for your perspective as somebody who knows the traditional investment space, but is deeply involved in impact strategy and ESG risk mitigation, do you genuinely believe that ESG is a driving force in business, or is it more of like a surface level effort and companies, when it comes down to it, like they're going to prioritize their returns?
Yeah. From my personal perspective, I think ESG risk mitigation, it's really the bare minimum that each company or fund should be doing to do no harm. And it's just being, you know, a good corporate citizen. I think that's where impact investing and gender lens being sort of one of the thematics under impact investing, where we, or investors, are being more intentional about creating change and driving impact and have clear targets and reporting metrics. Having that strategy or approach complement the basic ESG risk mitigation will probably form a more complete solution as to drive change in businesses.
You've mentioned risk mitigation now a couple times, and I did want to circle back to that and ask, like, what kinds of risks are you talking about associated, particularly with gender lens investing? I mean, obviously there will always be risks in investing, but like, what particular risks are kind of on your radar when you are advising your clients?
Yeah, this links back to the impact measurement process that we talked about earlier. Specifically for gender lens, the biggest risks we see is at Brightlight, we are really pushing for understanding, doing sort of beneficiary surveys or case studies. And that's really to hear from the people that you are wanting to impact, how it's improved or how it's changed their life. And that's where, I guess, beyond sort of validating some of the outputs, that's where you can start to get deeper into understanding impact outcome metrics and specifically well-being of or subjective well-being of these target beneficiaries. And yeah, I mean, hopefully they'll tell it as it is. I'm sure they will. But that's where I think having that direct beneficiary feedback loop allows us to further refine, all right, if that's not working, how can we change our process or strategy or activities to ensure that we address what the target beneficiary needs, and involving them in the design of the work. Obviously, it's a critical part of that as well, so that we're not designing something that we haven't consulted with the people that we're aiming to influence. And the great thing is there are heaps of resources available now on gender lens topics. So for all sort of interested practitioners, I highly recommend you to do research, and the sort of great resources that will help inform your own gender lens strategy.
So thinking about those risks, I want to turn now to talk about opportunities on the flip side. You've been in the space for a while, and I can't close this conversation without asking about the future and asking you to kind of predict the future. And I just think that's kind of a natural direction for our conversation to go, since you would advise investors. Looking at the next few years, what are you excited about in terms of gender lens investing, conversations that are happening, or initiatives that you're seeing, or momentum? Like what excites you about that space, thinking about the next few years?
What we currently see as the main trend is the increasing intersection of gender lens and climate investing. I think, Sonia, as you mentioned earlier, that's really the forefront of, I guess, in terms of the landscape at the moment. And then that seems to be a natural fit between financing both gender lens projects and climate mitigation and adaptation projects, because, yeah, as you mentioned earlier, women being disproportionately impacted by climate change, but they're also not represented or not well represented in the decision making roles to make those changes. So that seems like a real natural fit. And our hope at Brightlight is that gender lens investing just becomes increasingly integrated as part of any investment process that all our investors have. And it's not a kind of a side topic, good to have the check mark, but it becomes increasingly integrated as part of the whole investment analysis process.
Yeah, that does sound really exciting. I started this conversation by sharing a personal story of some research that I did a couple months ago. I wonder if we can close our conversation with a personal story from you. Like, do you have a personal success story or like a memorable experience related to your work in gender lens investing that's inspired you and reaffirms the importance of this approach?
In my previous role, we had invested into a social enterprise that was based in the Philippines, and they intentionally train and recruit and create income opportunities for women from abusive and vulnerable backgrounds specifically. Reading about some of the testimonies and meeting them in person when I was there in Philippines, and seeing the degree of transformation and joy of them being sort of reintegrated meaningfully back into society, I think that really inspired me and really validates the importance of having a gender lens. And
that is really inspiring. I mean, that is something that is close to my heart, because I firmly believe that finance is on the front lines of the fight against intimate partner violence around the world, because the first place that women go when they need to leave a destructive situation is to their bank. Like, they need money to leave, and that offers an opportunity for the financial sector. And you being in Australia, you know this, the Banking Association has a big emphasis on that too. So, I could see how that is an inspiring story for you. Gosh, I wish we had like an hour more. Yeah. This has been a really fun conversation. Thank you so much, Ivan, for joining me today on the Making Finance Work for Women podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that was really special. I always like to end our conversation with some reflections and thoughts about what you, our listener, can take away from this. So if you are an investor and you're looking for like an entry point to a viable ESG strategy, you can call up Ivan. Or there are other ways that you can take a gender lens investment approach, and you can do so with maximized returns and maximized social impact. Like having women on the board shouldn't be the only aspect you're looking at. You can dive into the business model of the companies that you're thinking about investing in and their plans to better serve women customers. Here are some really concrete examples. Like, you could agree prior to the investment with management and shareholders to work together on improving certain indicators, like the percent of women served in each product category. Or you could exercise your shareholder and board rights to influence decision-making and ideally make gender-disaggregated key performance indicators part of the management's key performance indicators that they report to the board on. Or you could provide or arrange for providing technical assistance to help the company meet those metrics and targets, and then you can monitor and report on gender-disaggregated metrics. And we talked a little bit about that, Ivan and I, today. You can also, anybody can actively engage with investment platforms and companies that promote gender lens investing and prioritize social responsibility. You can reach out to your financial advisor and your investment firm that's managing your money to inquire about their ESG-focused investment options for you, and specifically those that emphasize gender equality. Even if they don't have any, they should know that there's a demand out there for it. So you can encourage the financial industry to expand its offerings in this area. And you can consider supporting businesses and initiatives that empower women economically, whether it's investing in women-led startups or supporting organizations that provide financial education to women, contributing to microfinance programs. Your financial support can directly impact women's economic empowerment efforts. I mentioned you can support Women's World Banking, but there are lots of other ways that you can support organizations that are doing this if this is something you really believe in. And then finally, you can educate yourself and others. One powerful action you can take is to continue educating yourself, educating others about gender lens investing and its impact on ESG objectives and companies' bottom lines. You can stay informed about companies and investment opportunities that prioritize gender equality. And you can do this by sharing your knowledge with family and friends and colleagues to create awareness about the importance of gender-focused investment strategies. By spreading the word, you can contribute to building a community of informed investors and advocates for gender equality in the financial world. Even if you're just somebody who has like a very tiny retirement account, this is a step that you can take. And finally, mark your calendar for our next session in November, when we'll be back with another episode on the third Thursday of the month. Remember, it's always the third Thursday, and believe it or not, we are releasing this on the third Thursday. I can't believe this month is going by so fast. Next month, I'm going to be joined by a distinguished guest to explore the importance of physical touch points amid the digital revolution to effectively engage women customers and increase their financial inclusion. We'll use funny words like fidgetal, and we'll talk about this interplay and this like really interesting time that we're in with regards to digital finance, but also customer preference for person-to-person interaction. So join us next time. And thanks again for tuning in to the Making Finance Work for Women podcast.